Peter Wall is the senior teacher and spiritual director of Treetop Zen Center. He is also the guiding teacher for the Wild Fox Sangha, a virtual Zen group. Peter's primary spiritual interests are eco-dharma and more broadly eco-spirituality. He has facilitated nature connecting workshops as an eco-spiritual guide since 2001. Peter studied shamanism for 2 years with Dory Cote in Maine and has also learned from indigenous teachers while living in Arizona in the late 1990s. He is also a registered Maine guide. With a master's in counseling psychology from Antioch New England Graduate School, Peter has traveled in the behavioral health field. Traveled and worked in the behavioral health field for over two decades. His primary professional interest is in the treatment of substance use disorders. He is currently the clinical director of Behavioral Health Resources of Maine. So let's welcome Peter for our topic today. Thank you, Peter. Welcome.
Thank you all. Thank you. You know, I just so moved by the story that you just told. And, you know, to me, it's so important to hear those stories about young people. And that's where I derive hope from. You know, my tenure in this earth walk is nearing its end. But to know that there are people like that who truly get it, truly and deeply care and manifest, it's just wonderful. So thank you for that story. I don't know where you all are, but I'm here in Maine, Unity, Maine. And I sat outside for a little while before coming in for this. And it's really the first day that the fullness of spring is just there, you know, and we still have snow on the ground, but fortunately it's beating a hasty retreat. And so the spring like things are just emerging and the birds are singing. There's a couple of woodpeckers out this morning and the partridge are drumming. And then for the first time, there's a fairly large vernal pond behind the house. And, as of yesterday, there was ice. And when I was sitting out there this morning, all of a sudden I heard what I thought was some frogs peeping. And sure enough, I walked back there and the ice is gone overnight. Poof. And, you know, the tree frogs and the wood frogs are starting their emergence. So it's a very, very wonderful morning here, which made me think of a story about a Zen master, Ryokan. And this is a well-known story. You may know it. And Ryokan lived a life of poverty, and he had a little kind of hut that he lived in. And he was sitting in his little hut with very few worldly possessions when a thief came in. And the thief demanded that Ryokan give him something. It was his clothing, whatever. And Ryokan handed it to him. And then Ryokan said, well, wait a minute. He said, I've got more stuff here. And he started handing him everything. He handed him all of his possessions in the little hut, believing that perhaps this man needed it more than he did. And when the fellow left, Ryokan looked up and the moon was shining. And he said, I wish I could have given him this beautiful moon. So that's my wish this morning. I wish I could give you all the peepers and the partridge, and I hope that you're someplace where you can connect with those things. At this really very wonderful time of year. So talk about synchronicities, and you know, I recently came back, a couple of weeks ago, I spent a month in the Southwest visiting sacred lands and sacred sites. It's something I wanted to do for a while. And those of you who've been out there probably know that there's a power to the land, to the light, to every aspect of the Southwest that we kind of miss out on in some ways here in New England. And I lived out there for a few years, so I really wanted to get back. And I made this trip. And really what emerged as one of the themes of the trip was the soil. And in fact, I'm starting working on a little book about that. And it, my sort of working title is Spirituality from the Soil Up. And I brought back some containers. One of the places that I visited there was the Santuaria de Chimayo. Which is a very famous little church in New Mexico. And one of the things they have is sacred soil. They have a room. And you have to go down a passageway to get to this room. And it's a kind of narrow, dark passageway. And the wall on one side is lined with canes and crutches of people who've come to this sanctuary and experienced some type of miraculous healing. And it's amazing. There's hundreds of these things standing there. And on the other side of that wall, people have placed photos of loved ones who they're hoping to have some protection and some healing. And the vast majority of these photos were young people in the military, which was both poignant and terribly sad, right? You know, and then there was a section of that devoted to members of law enforcement who had been killed in action. And faces of these wonderful young people who had been lost to violence. It was a tremendously powerful experience. And that outpouring of love from families and friends. And all of that was poured into this space, into this relatively tiny space. And then you went back and there was a small room. I don't know if it was 8x8 or it couldn't have been more than that. And the center of that room was this dirt in the floor. And that was the sacred earth from the sanctuary. And you could take some. And so I have a couple of little containers of that sacred earth on my altar here. So I just really resonated with that story about the earth and really perfect accompaniment to what I would like to talk about today. Now, those of you who have had the privilege of aging as I have know that there are many wonderful things that come with being old. And I won't enumerate those, but I will say, you know, one of the things for me was that I was at a point where I was able to square off and I said, I'm never going to put on a suit and tie again. And I'm never going to give a formal talk again. I used to do these PowerPoint things, you know, and lectures said, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to relate to people that way. I don't want to talk to that people that way. I want to talk to people face to face. And so that's what I'd like to do this morning. So I know there's like a formal time to interact towards the end, but I'm going to encourage you along the way. If you'd like to interact, please, please do. It helps me a lot to get to know you and to get, you know, to kind of know what it is you'd like to hear and that sort of thing. So I just will kind of open that here.
Yeah, please, Peter, it is your hour to do anything you want to do with. So.
Oh, well, don't go that far. But but anyway, yes, please feel free. You know, I will pause frequently. I'm going to do some readings and some things. And when I do pause, please, if you have a comment or a rebuttal or whatever, you know, feel free. That will make this hour really worthwhile.
I can't help but have a comment. 1989, we were running the New Mexico Marathon, and we also were at Sanctuario de Chimayo, and I had a little statue and a prayer card from there, and of course a little, back then it was a little film canister of the sacred mud. And for Easter, I gave the statue and the prayer to our neighbor and their little children. And I hadn't gotten it out of my studio or looked at it in all these years. And then you brought it up today, and it kind of felt really bizarre.
Synchronicity. It's everywhere. It's yeah. Everywhere.
So anyway.
Thank you.
And we ran the marathon.
That's a high altitude to run a marathon.
No, we did it a mile. What is it? A minute, a mile slower. And I got to know this one fellow for 20 miles very well.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place there. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful place. So I'm going to start with a little section from my book called Awakening. On a hot August day, I found myself sitting atop a hill above the Verde River in northern Arizona, participating in a sacred rite. As the sun rose higher in the sky and the day grew hotter, I prayed fervently as I could for some vision or sign that would help guide my life. I intently scanned the earth and sky, hoping to catch a glimpse of a bird or an animal bringing me a message. The desert afternoon was very still. There was no breeze. As the hours passed, despite my vigilance, I detected no movement anywhere in the valley below me. The only sound I could hear was the steady buzzing of flies. Suddenly, from behind me, I heard a voice call out, "Hey!" I turned quickly to see where it came from. In that direction, there was nothing but desert for a long way. No humans were anywhere around. But right in front of me, about eye level, looking straight at me, was a dragonfly. The only way I can describe that moment is to say that the familiar world broke apart. My heart was so deeply touched that tears started to stream down my face. I looked around and saw dragonflies and butterflies all around me, dancing on the afternoon thermals. Overwhelmed by ecstasy and still weeping, I began to dance with them. Anyone seeing me at that moment, leaping and gyrating on that hilltop, would have thought I had gone mad. In a sense, I had. All my inhibitions had left. Nothing existed outside of that moment and my new winged friends on the hilltop. My wild mind had been released from decades of repression. At that moment, I was suddenly transported back to the summer when I was 12 years old. I was at a summer camp that I hated. I felt desperately alone because I did not connect with the other campers whose interests were very different from mine. My only solace was a small field guide to wildflowers, which I had purchased at the camp commissary. Whenever I had spare time, I wandered off into the wild, sunny meadows, seeking flowers to identify. I remember wishing that I could somehow melt into those meadows, losing my separate human identity in a ray of sunshine and becoming part of that beloved landscape. Now, 40 years later, on that afternoon in Arizona, the circle was complete. I intuitively understood that nature was always there as a place of sanctuary for the soft, vulnerable core of my being, if I could make that heartfelt connection with the presence of wildness. Looking back now, more than two decades after that day in Arizona, I realized how profound a shift occurred for me on that hill. I had reconnected with the deep, lifelong urge to lose my separate identity and become one with the natural world. Something deep within my unconscious being had never been content with being a stranger in a strange land, alienated from my ancestral home in the world. For me, the journey to intimacy with the wild and a connection with the omnipresence of the divine in the world had begun. I was coming home. Through that experience, I moved from being a voyeuristic visitor in the natural world to wanting to enter a deep and ultimately seamless connection with the wild. Intimacy with the world is our birthright, the deepest longing of our souls. Yeah, so before that event, I had lived only in Arizona only for a few short years, but prior to that, I had lived in Vermont for over 20 years, and I had spent lots of time in the outdoors. I was a hiker. I studied forestry. I ran a farm for a while, and being out in nature was very important to me for my entire adult life. But as I talk about to some extent in the book, it had been a very exploitive hierarchical relationship, and there's a real parallel between our colonizing of humans and our colonizing of the natural world. And just as our European civilizations came in and dominated and destroyed indigenous peoples and cultures, so we followed that same path in our relationship to the natural world. We brought domination, control, greed, all of those sorts of things. Into the way that we related to nature and to the world. And it's something that as you all know, I know I'm talking to the choir here, that, this is the very root of what's destroying the planet today. The very root rises right out of that fundamental relationship, and that sort of hierarchical male domination that we have brought to the planet and we have brought to all of our natural relations as we did to indigenous peoples. So that sort of segues into this, a little chapter here on decolonizing our minds. Like most people in this culture, my relationship with wildness was torn away as I grew up. Why I did not permanently lose my affinity for the wild is something of a mystery to me. Perhaps this was because of those early encounters with the last remaining tastes of the other than human world, those few places that had not been completely consumed by the inexorable advance of urbanization. And I should add a note here. So I grew up on the fringes of New York City. I did not grow up in a particularly wild place. But I distinctly remember my father taking me back into the woods on a cool gray November day to make a fire and roast potatoes in the coals. Peeling back the thick blackened skin revealed the soft white inner flesh of the tuber as plumes of the richly perfumed smoke wafted towards our noses. Never before or ever since have I tasted such sweetness as that potato, liberally garnished with wood smoke and infused with the November scents of moldering leaves and crisp cold air. Perhaps those experiences awakened an ancient memory that floated just below the threshold of my consciousness for the next decade. Eventually, that memory of living in connection with wildness, the way my distant ancestors had, emerged and shaped my life for almost the next six decades. Whether we are in a great wood or a vacant lot, we can experience the welcoming connection that can restore, heal, inspire, and connect us intimately to the expansive presence. Whether we call that expression of God or goddess, Buddha nature, Gaia, the divine source, or simply nature. This experience of presence is freely available, and it is not the exclusive provenance of any single spiritual perspective. As children, our minds were still wild, unfettered by constraints. We relished getting our hands and feet in the dirt. We danced in the rain and splashed wildly in puddles. We awakened every sense as we ran, crawled, climbed, and tumbled through mysterious forests and unexplored jungles on great quests for new lands and strange beings. We loved to walk barefoot on dew-soaked grass and sandy beaches of summer, frolic in the piles of fallen leaves in the autumn, flop down and make angels in the cold winter snow, and gleefully turn somersaults on a new springtime carpet of wildflowers. Our culture seldom tolerates so much free-spirited exuberance. We are expected to be serious, to serve as dutiful cogs in the wheels of production and consumption. Don't get wet, you'll catch cold. Don't get your dress dirty. Don't go into the bushes, you never know what's there. While some of these admonitions may have been necessary for safety, the parent is consciously or unconsciously giving the child the message that the sanitary orderliness of the human world is more desirable than the crazy, spontaneous, jumbled reality of the wild. In so doing, we are tearing out the roots of our fundamental relationship with the natural world as we become civilized. Unfortunately, our 21st century minds have been so highly civilized that most of us cannot simply walk out into the wild and make the connection experienced by our ancestors. If we wish to cultivate a deeply relational appreciation of the natural world, it needs to begin with the decolonization of our psyche, allowing for the re-emergence of our wild mind. To restore a profound connection with nature, we begin by relearning to experience the openness, the joy, the spontaneity, the curiosity, and the freedom that we once knew as children. This does not mean we necessarily need to roll in the grass or splash in puddles, although we might decide to do that. It does mean we develop a renewed awareness that is not contaminated by shoulds and shouldn'ts, nor is wild awareness constrained by categories and labels. A child does not see Pinus strobus when they look at a white pine tree. They may not even know that it is a pine. They have no rigid boxes to narrowly define and constrict their experience of the tree. They simply see a friend to talk to, a shady place to sit under, or a welcoming limb to climb. In Zen Buddhism, we talk about non-knowing. This is the natural function of our mind when it is not bound up with defined structures, conventions, or cognitive schemas. It is the fresh, unconditioned apprehension of the world around us. It is therefore the antithesis of knowing, which is the certainty with which we bind reality into neat, relatively rigid packages. When we don't know, anything is possible. When we don't know, the present isn't determined by the past. We can live as if each moment is the first, which from a Buddhist and from an atomic physics perspective, it is. They view linear time as an illusion. The past, the present, and the future are all contained in this very moment. This is the moment of the Big Bang, and it is the moment when the universe ceases to exist. Therefore, when we don't know, we aren't locked into rigid conditioned responses. We can act freely and naturally in response to our immediate circumstances. Not knowing is also the state of non-separation, of intimacy. When we don't know, we don't create the narrow perspective where our ego stands apart from the world, coolly observing and continuously judging. We are right there, a part of it all, our feet planted firmly in the mud of the world. This not knowing is wild mind. One of the things I noticed when I spent time with my indigenous American friends was that rather than approaching the world through the intellect, as those of us who are more socialized by the dominant culture do, they met it with an open heart. When we can do that, the universe is a very different place. Instead of simply a collection of mechanical widgets whirling about in predetermined patterns, the world is a truly magical place, where the tangible spirit of nature is omnipresent. In that world, it is possible to experience animals speaking directly to us. It is possible for plants to teach us their healing medicine. It is possible to experience Mother Earth as a living being and a powerful spiritual entity. I'm going to pause there for a moment again.
Mary Rose.
Peter, you brought tears to my eyes talking about or reminding me of where I grew up, which was 20 miles from Boston, but it could have been thousands of miles because it wasn't the city and my cousins all lived in the city. We had chickens and cats and dogs and a creek and lots of woods behind us. And we experienced all the things you just talked about, going through the woods and falling through the ice and getting soaking wet, but not drowning, and playing in the brook and picking mint leaves and, you know, being in the garden, picking worms out of the dirt and potato bugs that my father told us to collect because they were hurting the plants. And it just brought back so many memories. And when our cousins would come from the city, we were just horrified at what they didn't know. And, you know, picking up the kitten by its leg or the chicken, it was just, we were horrified. They didn't know anything about animals and were afraid of them. And of course, now they're grown up and they all have dogs and whatever. But it just made me think of so many things being little. Thank you.
You're entirely welcome. Yeah. You know, I think that's one of the concerning things to me, you know, that many of our generations, the older generations, you know, had these experiences when we were young, even if we were in relatively urban or suburban kinds of areas, that there was, you know, a lot of freedom, go out and explore, crawl around, you know, dig holes, whatever. And I don't think kids today have that opportunity in the same way, you know, and they get helicoptered around from one thing to the next. And maybe that's sort of a natural consequence of a world that's less safe. I don't know. But I think, you know, that these kinds of childhood experiences are so integral to our developing our relationship with nature as adults. So I'm, you know, I'm a little concerned that kids don't have that as much today.
No.
Martha, why don't you go?
Well, I just was interested in your use of the word civilization, that especially in our political arena, civil is something that has gone out the window for a great many. And I think Wild assumes that those two words, civil and wild, in juxtaposition to each other, I see them as reversed, that the civil interaction that we have with nature is seemingly more and more prevalent as we try to heal the earth. We are being more civil to the planet, many of us. And the wild interactions that we have with those who are not of the same mindset. So I was just interested in how the juxtaposition of those two words and what they mean and how they can flip back and forth. So, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. No, well, I hadn't thought about it that way. I mean, you know, at least in the way I'm talking about it here, to me, wildness is a good thing. It's not a state that has been humanized, that has been subsumed to our goals, to our needs, but still retains its own integral nature. You know, the simplest way I could talk about that is in terms of our yards, right? You know, as way back in the 80s, I was doing some work with a woman who was from the EPA at that time. And at that time, the EPA was actually still the Environmental Protection Agency. She was talking about the fact that what a travesty lawns were. And this is something that's now kind of just getting recognized and coming back. So we take a natural space and we have this monoculture of grass, and to sustain that monoculture, we use chemicals and pesticides, and everything that might interfere with that, whether it's a wildflower or an insect, gets eradicated. So in effect, we create these kinds of green deserts. And to me, that's the contrast between the civilized and the wild. And, you know, and the wild is not orderly. It's a cacophony. It's, you know, and there's some things we like and there's some things we don't like. There's aspects. I struggle with that here. On our land, it's mostly wooded except for a large marsh that's in the center. And we've been here for 5 years, not very long, we try to do it the least we can to change it, the least we can to interfere with it. And that's kind of a mixed blessing. You know, people come into the forest here and they go, oh, look at all those dead trees and all those dying trees. And, you know, da, da, you know, and that's what nature does. It's not the most beautiful arrangement in terms of our aesthetics. You know, and I could certainly go in and cut things down and manipulate the forest in ways that we humans would find it more aesthetically satisfying. But to me, it would lose that quality of wildness. It would lose that quality of nature. And it's very present, you know, this anthropocentric attitude. That what we like, what we need, and what we want is most important. And therefore, we need to bend nature to our will, to our agendas. You know, now I'd probably take that to a little more extreme than many people. There's many people who would make an argument, well, having a nicely managed forest is not bad, and it probably helps reduce some insect infestations and so on. And that's certainly a cogent argument. But, right now I'm just valuing having this space that's doing what it needs to without my interference.
I wanted to comment on something, and thank you, Martha, because perhaps what has happened is the word wild has been co-opted and twisted a little bit so that it becomes frightening. Peter, I wanted to share a set of three things that I feel are synchronous that's happened since the end of March. So I was part of a program where we often go out on the land and listen, spend time that way. And at this particular moment in March, I went out on the land and spent about an hour sitting with what I would have called a clump of daffodils before I sat with them. After I sat with them for an hour, I more could feel them as a family of daffodils. That they were connected to each other, that clump was a kind of pejorative word in my way of thinking. But as I sat with them and could see how, I could just feel how they were related to each other. They were leaning on each other. They were leaning on some of the leaves. Some were in the other's shadow. Some were just budding. Some had been there for a while. And I had this, I don't know if it's a message I got or a sense I got that for me to go in and take one out, to cut one out of that group was not okay. And I had never had that sense before that it's maybe it's not right or wrong, but that it was really coming into a family grouping or a community grouping and taking something out for me. Then the next week in Sunday Comics, which were on the Boston Globe comic page, there was actually quite a large one-frame comic that had some people going and picking flowers, again, out of a community of flowers. And the flowers that were left behind called out, goodbye, Mom, goodbye, Dad, goodbye, Peter. And they were saying goodbye to each other back and forth, you know, obviously using English and, you know, regular names. And I thought, I've never seen that referred to anywhere. And it happened within a few days of my having this experience with the daffodils. And then in the paper this week, there was a little tiny article that said that this woman had put microphones next to potted tobacco and potted tomatoes. And that she was in a silent, they were in a silent room, and they picked up sounds that both the tobacco plants and the tomato plants were making. And that when they got extra dry, they made a different sound. And when somebody cut one of their stalks, they made a different sound, that they were actually responding to what had been done with them. So to have all these three things happen sort of within a time frame of each other, just paying attention, they feel like a dotted line, you know, that I could connect. And I don't quite know what to do with that message that why would I interrupt that community group for my own pleasure? So I just offer that question and that story and don't know how to live with it, but I'm offering it.
Thank you. I personally am a believer in panpsychism and believe that all of the natural beings are sentient and also have the ability to communicate. And although they don't necessarily do that in words, and in fact, more often than not, they don't in words. English is their second language. So they often do tell us things, you know, that we get at a level that's so sort of intuitive that we can tend to be like, oh, you know, I don't know about that, you know, but it's, you know, I think it's very important that we begin, among other things, to listen to those subtle heart messages that come to us from the natural world. Again, indigenous cultures have always known this. They've always known that all of these beings have, in their language, spirit, that they have identities, that they are, you know, they are our neighbors. They are our friends. They are not just things that we can use as we will. And I think our sophisticated scientific understanding is starting to make that circle back. You know, just the studies that people mentioned with tobacco, tomatoes, these things are starting to happen. That we're starting to say, hey, we need to pay attention in a different way. You know, when indigenous people who have plant medicine in their cultures are asked how they learned that. How did you learn that this plant heals that or that? And the answer is universally, the plants told us. And that's part of why, you know, some of these attempts by pharmaceutical companies and others to go into places like the Amazon and find medicines have failed. Because what we thought we needed, what they've gone and done is they've gone in and deconstructed. And it must be the components, the constituents, the molecules that are there. And if we can break these plants down to their the molecular levels, we can figure out why they're healing. And of course, that's not it at all, you know, and it's not molecular healing. I think we're starting to learn that.
Ivo, is that your hand? Marianne, next?
Yeah. I was drawing Peter with dragonflies. I don't know if you can see it. And,
you just drew that, Ivo.
Yeah, with his words. So thank you, Peter, because I just started drawing again. And, living in the woods for a few months with no running water, whatever. I was lost one night. I was waiting for my dog to run down the path, half a mile, and show me the way. And I was completely lost. And finally, you know, I kind of went down a brook because I thought I'll lose the scent of something larger following me. And then I found a tree stump and it was completely pitch black, middle of the summer up in Vermont. I couldn't see a thing. And I just crawled up on the tree stump and went into a ball. And the tree stump said, "You're okay. You'll be all right." So, I never forgot that tree stump. It was the back of Stratton Mountain. But, sometimes you have to get out in the wild. And I'm a painter. And so, and my husband does this as well. We're walking around. And we say, if there's a tree, oh, he's saying this, or she's saying that, or the flower just said this. So they're all talking back and forth.
Again, strange synchronicities. I've only been really, really lost in the woods once, on the back of Stratton Mountain in Vermont.
Oh. No, the miracle mud was one thing, but now I'm getting a little bizarre. Did I tell you our piano is making two notes every once in a while? It plays two notes all by itself. I don't know.
Okay.
Marianne, did you have your hand up?
But Luis does.
Oh, Luis. Oh, yeah. I never remember to look at the little yellow hands. Okay, Luis.
Oh, hi. Hi, Peter. I'm I'm experimenting a conflict right now. On the one side, we humans go to nature and take away from it and destroy it in the process. On the other side, I'm able to enjoy listening to you thanks to Zoom and computers and all the minerals that were taken away from the earth in order to get all this technology going. So on the one side, I can see that we destroyed the planet. And on the other side, I would have never been able to listen to you if it wasn't from the Zoom and the technology that is here present. So I don't know how to put where to keep the balance.
Well, thank you, Luis. That's a wonderful question, and it's a thing that I struggle with as well. And let me say, as a Zen Buddhist, one of our precepts we have in my lineage, 16 precepts that we follow. And one of those precepts is the precept of not killing. Okay. And it's simple. I vow to take up the way of not killing. Although a very significant way that it's different from, let's say, the Christian commandment of thou shalt not kill, or at least in how that's understood, is that the precept doesn't make any exceptions. I vow to take up the way of not killing. It doesn't say, I vow to take up the way of not killing other humans. I vow to take up the way of not killing unless it's in a war or, you know, there's no exceptions. I vow to take up the way. So I violate that precept every single moment of the day. Every breath I am killing. Every meal I am killing. Even if I was a vegan, I'd be killing things in order to eat and in order to survive. So at a certain level, killing other beings is absolutely, unavoidably inherent to our lives. If I go to take a walk in the woods, I'm killing. And I try to avoid all the little trees and little plants. I try to, you know, doesn't matter. I'm still stepping on things and I'm hurting them. So therefore, you know, as I see the precept and as I, you know, is that I have several aspects of responsibility here. My primary responsibility is to kill as little as possible. I cannot live and not kill, but I can minimize. I can avoid unnecessary. You know, and in that sense, again, I look to indigenous people. They killed animals to eat. You know, I don't know of any indigenous tribes that were vegetarians, unless perhaps they lived in the tropics. But they always did it carefully, respectfully, and without waste. And I think that's where we go wrong, is when we're not careful, when we're not respectful, and when we're wasteful. And when we're not, you know, it's kind of like deep ecology. We need to constantly see what we're doing, and are we doing it in the least harmful manner? Are we doing, you know, and as far as I can see, that's the best we can do, you know, but you're absolutely right, you know, and just by being alive, we're doing some harm. And therefore, you know, I think we also have, you know, some responsibilities to rectify and to take care of and to remediate the destruction that we cause.
Thank you. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you. Kind of getting into the, I'd like to segue to this idea of co-creation, if I may.
Yeah. Bethany, you had her hand up.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Bethany?
Sorry about that. Thanks. I'll be quick. I just wanted to respond to some things that people were saying that inspired me. Just the last one, Louise, what you said made me think about how in nature, in the fundamental cycles of birth and death and everything that's created in that time, everything is recycled like for the good of the whole. So sometimes I when I'm thinking about all of this technology and crazy complexity that humans have developed and how I think, well, gosh, I wouldn't want to do without that entirely. I always think, well, actually, some of these things that we've created, which might be inherently destructive, nature, the whole of the system, ends up using them for her own good in the end. So sort of like taking what we've constructed and then using those channels and pathways to heal herself, which results in things like meetings like these, where people who are interested in this kind of healing and reconnection are, can actually do that. So it's really interesting just to see that circular recycling that that nature enacts.
Thank you, Bethany. Okay, back to you, Peter.
Okay. So since I had co-creation in the title, I thought I ought to talk about it a little here. The waters of Hubbard Brook arise from a small wetland only about a mile from our home at Turtle Marsh. Flashing in the morning sunlight, they run clear and bright as they pass under the small wooden footbridge that I cross on my daily walk. From there, they continue their journey into the marsh, mingling with the waters of the larger Frybrook Brook before they continue on to join the much larger Sandy Stream. Eventually, they enter the Great Kennebec River and complete their passage to the Atlantic Ocean. On an early summer morning, the relative quiet of the forest was abruptly shattered by the roaring sounds of great monsters. Chainsaws and heavy equipment were whining and crashing like dinosaurs, so it was just a little way upstream from the marsh. Walking in that direction, I could hear large trees crashing to the ground. I knew immediately that a logging job was underway. Logging is an event almost everywhere in the Maine woods. For small woodlot owners who own most of the woodland in southern and central Maine, timber harvesting produces some income for the landowner, which is often needed to pay the property taxes. It also creates employment for the loggers, the truckers, the sawmill operators, and others in the chain of producing forest products. These harvesting operations tend to be small, commensurate with the size of the property ownerships. I have come to accept the fact that commercial timbering is omnipresent in Maine, the most forested state in the lower 48. Nevertheless, as I walked along the stream that morning, I was profoundly disturbed. Skidders, being large, heavy machines, always do a lot of damage to the shrubs, the small trees, and other forest vegetation as they move through the woods. Between that collateral and the collateral damage of the slash, the tops and branches that are left behind when the logger removes the bole of the tree, a recent logging job is seldom a pleasant sight, especially when it is carelessly done and a high-grade job that ignores the quality of the residual stand of trees, which this was. A high-grade log job takes only the most commercially valuable trees to maximize short-term profits. There is no attention given to the future value of the stand or to maintaining appropriate stand densities. The high-grade cut usually leaves far fewer trees than are optimal for overall growth, and many of those are both the least commercially valuable species and the most poorly formed or damaged specimens. Over time, this practice progressively degrades the health and commercial quality of the forest. Aesthetically and commercially, high-grade logging is a disaster. However, this morning, I witnessed something that was even more disturbing. The skidder operator had repeatedly run his machine right through the brook, making no attempt to mitigate the damage that the huge, heavily lugged tires were doing. The banks and the bed of the stream were torn up, leaving huge, muddy ruts that filled with murky brown water. The logging slash had been left wherever it had fallen, including right in the stream bed, clogging the waterway. Across the entire planet, indigenous peoples regard the waters as sacred and believe that we are obliged to protect them. They understand that water is life, that if we don't honor and protect the water, suffering and extinction will follow. Already, there are massive water shortages in many parts of the world, heralding what is to come if we do not change our ways of interacting with water. When I first came here to Turtle Marsh, we invited Charlie Riverman, a friend and water protector, to perform a ceremony of blessing the waters. We have continued to honor the sacredness of the brooks and the marsh, thanking and blessing them regularly. Seeing the wanton disregard for the waters of the brook, the stream bed clogged with debris, and the clear waters turned dark with mud brought me to tears. Masaru Emoto, a Japanese researcher, conducted a fascinating series of experiments demonstrating the relationship between consciousness and water. Emoto developed a method to rapidly freeze water and prepare slides so that he could observe the crystalline structure. In his initial experiment, he had a Buddhist priest bless the water and observe the crystals both before and after the blessing. The transformation was dramatic, for the crystalline structure of the blessed water was much more orderly and well-defined, and the ice was clearer and brighter. Emoto subsequently conducted many more experiments with water crystals and the simple expression of intention in human consciousness. A number of those involved placing water in glass bottles, where he placed labels with words written on them on the outside of the bottles. The words included positive ones such as love and peace, and negative ones such as anger and hatred. After standing in these containers, the water was frozen and the crystals were examined. Once again, the results were dramatic. The crystalline structure of the water that was shown a positive word had a beautiful, well-formed crystals. The water that was shown a negative word had crystals that were dark and deformed. Interestingly, the two words that had the most profound positive effect on the water crystals were love and gratitude. These experiments eventually extended to such things as having people surround a large polluted lake in Japan to offer Buddhist prayers. In this case, the initial crystals were brownish and deformed, but became markedly clearer and beautifully formed after the prayer. Emoto's work is a concrete demonstration of the possibility of a co-creative relationship with our waters. It suggests that if we enter a loving, prayerful relationship with the waters, we can help transform and purify them. Despite being disregarded as pseudo-scientific by some, this research has incredibly broad implications in furthering our understanding of the relationship between consciousness and matter. The ability of water to be transformed had also been observed by German scientists. They found that under extremely high magnification, each drop of water taken from the same source has a unique structure. However, if they placed a flower in the water, every droplet assumed an identical new structure. If they placed a flower of a different species into the water, all the droplets assumed a pattern that was unique to that species. Their conclusion was that a new perception of water was formed. The German scientists believed that as water travels, it picks up and stores information from all of the places that it has traveled through, which can thereby connect people to a lot of different places and sources of information when they drink this water, depending on the journey that it has been on. This discovery that water takes on and retains an imprint from the things that it encounters is an important parallel to Emoto's work. For those of us who want to heal the waters and use transformed waters to heal others. Furthermore, when we realize that the bodies of living beings contain a high percentage of water, these implications are even greater. Guided by our friend Charlie Riverman, we held a ceremony for the damaged Hubbard Brook shortly after the logging stopped. Our immediate neighbors, Audrey and Ben, a young couple who care deeply for this forest and stream, joined us. Charlie explained that he visualized the area where the logging had severely disrupted the stream as a wound. He instructed us to perform specific prayers and blessings while holding clear intentions both above and below the wound. That ceremony took place in August. In late October, I took a walk up along the stream to where the wound had been and was amazed by what I found there. The banks were fully vegetated, and there was no sign of the muddy ruts caused by the skitters. The water, in spite of being greatly diminished by a summer drought, were now flowing clear and bright. The only indication that this had been the site of a wound was some logging slash that remained in the water. Well, this, excuse me, I said, take a little drink. Why, this may well have healed in this fashion through the summer without the benefit of the ceremonial intervention. The astonishing complete healing of the wound in that short period of time convinces me that this is a demonstration of co-creation, conscious human spiritual intention working synergistically with the healing powers of Mother Earth herself.
Could you read that definition again, please?
Sure. Just this last sentence that I read?
Yeah, how you're defining co-creation. Yeah.
Okay. Yep, sure. The astonishing complete healing of the wound in that short period of time convinces me that this is a demonstration of co-creation, conscious human spiritual intention working synergistically with the healing powers of Mother Earth herself.
Thank you. Well, we are at 103, so we want to thank you for this portion, Peter, that you've offered and led us through. And we're just opening it up right now, which means I'm available for any questions or comments from what I talked about, and you're available, and we're as a community trying to learn some things and sort them out. So does anyone have questions, comments, things that they're thinking about, memories that they might be having?